Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Freezing temperatures are gripping Michigan for another day. For people living on the streets, this weather is indeed life-threatening. On today's show, we check in to see how shelters across the state are coping with the cold. And this year's Arab Film Festival opens this week in Dearborn. We'll look at the films being screened and find out what they say about the Arab-American community and the Arab world in 2013. But first, a warning bell was sounded for Michigan this week. Not by the governor, not by lawmakers. This latest warning comes from the group Business Leaders of Michigan. This group is made up of CEOs and top execs of the state's biggest job providers and universities. They point out that between 2002 and 2012, Michigan's spending per student on higher education dropped 35%. At the same time, spending per prisoner jumped 42%. So we are pumping more money into prisons and jails at the same time we're giving less to colleges and universities. So says Detroit News business writer Daniel Howes in his piece published in the news this week. Dan, you essentially called out the state of Michigan, leaders past and present. What are you hoping readers get from your piece?
Well, I'm hoping that people get a little perspective here. You know, the long-term trends are not encouraging, and Michigan is lagging its peer states in terms of what it's spending on higher ed. And frankly, given the under-degreed population that we have, you could make the argument that we need to be a lot more focused on education as a way to rebuild our economy. You know, if you look at some of the degree statistics, Michigan has pretty much stayed around 24% of the adults have 4-year degrees or higher, compared to a state like Massachusetts, where you have 40% of the adults that have those kind of degrees. Now, there are people that would certainly suggest that a degree is not a panacea, and I would agree with that, but it is typically a gateway to higher earnings and to different kinds of jobs that tend to be more value-added. And our economy is changing. And I think one of the things the business leaders are saying is we need to be focusing on this and recognize what's happening. Now, all that said, Michigan also has, among the top 10 most violent cities in America, we have 4 of them. In Detroit, Flint, Saginaw, and Pontiac. And we also have the highest violent crime rate in the Midwest. So it's not an accident that we're spending the money. Now, the question, I think, really becomes, is it an either-or proposition? And I think people on both sides of this would say, no, it's not. It's not you have to favor one exclusively over the other. It's a question of how you balance it. And are there policy changes that Michigan, both on the higher ed side and on the correction side, might be able to make that will change the way things are playing out? And there are a number of different examples that you can look at that might be things that we ought to be doing.
Well, I want to get back to kind of the history of this. What do you feel was behind that shrinkage of funding? The business leaders for Michigan pinpointed 2002 when John Engler was still governor. Do you agree with that start date?
Well, I think if you go back and you look at the charts that they put together on this, the funding for higher ed really started to drop fairly precipitously in the mid-90s. And then it dropped a lot more in the Granholm years as a percentage and as a percentage of the general fund. And at that time, what you also see is that tuition and fees at the state universities around the 2002 timeframe really started to take off. So yeah, they were trying to make up for the lost funding. That essentially makes higher ed less affordable for more people as this continues to march upward.
What caused that decrease?
Well, you have to make choices. And here you have a state that in the Granholm years was increasingly pressured from a public finance perspective in terms of how they were going to do it. Now, I happen to think that you can also make an argument that is the constituencies that are the most powerful as a lobby group in the Capitol tended to be more effective at minimizing their losses. You know, college professors, it's like herding a bunch of cats. Some of them are unionized, a lot of them are not. They don't have necessarily the same kinds of effective lobbying machine that, say, K-12 education or corrections does in the state capitol.
So they didn't have that strong voice to basically stick up for higher ed.
Exactly. Now, that's not going to be a popular view among some people, but I think that you know, you got to believe me or your lying eyes. I mean, you can see what's happened here in terms of how things have been turned on its head. And I think it's, to some extent, a reflection of the political values in Lansing. And unfortunately, it may be a reflection of the culture of the state. You know, this is historically an old economy, industrialized state, tended to be blue collar, tended to be union. That's changing, but sometimes old cultures die hard.
If you're just joining us, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, looking at spending on higher education in the state of Michigan as we talk with Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Is it easy, I wonder, to make universities, let's say, the whipping boy or the scapegoat, as it were, that it's easy to cut university funding because there's this sense students are graduating after their four or more years in university with degrees that don't lead to good jobs, especially in Michigan's economy. So you have students and their families ending up in deep debt, no good job, and the kid's still living at home trying to launch his life. So is there something in that dynamic that makes it easier for Lansing spending?
Yes, but if you talk to people, I think, in higher ed, they will tell you that one of their great frustrations is they offer so many things to students, ways to educate, to better themselves, whether it's career counseling, whether it's additional classes, whatever the case may be, and they don't avail themselves of it. I mean, at some point, you know, there is a personal responsibility, I think, here as to are you going to take the opportunities that are handed to you at a Michigan or a Michigan State and really maximize them. And frankly, a lot of students don't. I have a daughter who's a senior in college. Mm-hmm. She and not in the state of Michigan, but she's done very well and I think has taken advantage of an awful lot of things. But I know some of her classmates don't necessarily do that. And certainly I know the story you're talking about. I think the other thing that goes on here is the universities and colleges are a whipping boy because there's a perception that they don't do any real work there.
A perception held by whom? By lawmakers?
I think by their critics. I mean, certainly when I wrote this column and it was published yesterday, I got emails on both sides of this, and people on the anti side basically said, number one, we got a crime problem in the state, and we should mm-hmm. be spending on prisons.
Okay.
And number two, all they do in colleges and universities is consume money, and they don't produce a whole lot. And the perception is that all of the professors, and I put that in quotes, mm-hmm. all of the professors, all they do is do their research, and they're not interested in teaching kids, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of generalizations that go on, but I think you dismiss those at your peril because they are powerful in a political context when they're carving up and just making decisions about who gets what, how big a piece of the pie. And ultimately what's happened, I think the numbers show, is that higher ed in Michigan has gotten a smaller and smaller piece of the pie over the last decade and even going back 15 years. And it's really kind of hard to deny. So the question is, what are you going to do about
it? Right.
And there are things that they can do on the prisons and the correction side. You know, we operate smaller prisons than the Great Lakes, our Great Lakes peers, and nationally. So we don't reap some of the economies of scale. Higher ed, as a general rule, if our schools were accepting out-of-state students at the same rate that their peer institutions in other states were admitting, according to Business Leaders from Michigan, that would be about $200 million in additional tuition mm-hmm. revenue every mm-hmm. year. And then if you add on top of it the books and the spending and that those kids are doing in the local economies, you can factor that up as much as five times. So that could be as much as another $1 billion of money coming into the state. So there are ways that they can start to address this. Now, I know at the University of Michigan, they say we're already admitting, because of the kind of university they are, they're already admitting up to kind of where their peers are in terms of out-of-state students.
Right. And we see a lot of that at Michigan State, foreign students, the largest amount
exactly
they've ever
right.
had. Yeah,
exactly right. And so, I mean, there's probably more that can be done there. And certainly the universities have got to do their own thing. But, you know, politically, I think as a matter of policy, one of the things that Business Leaders has pointed out is that in other states that have done this really well, and they focus on North Carolina, they've kind of looked at this and said, this is what is going to be important for us going forward. And whether it's Republicans or Democrats who are in control in the state capitol, typically the funding for higher ed in North Carolina tends to track at the same level. And as a result, you can get more kids. It's more affordable for them to go to a state college and university in North Carolina than it is in Michigan. And that's just kind of the real world.
Well, we heard the governor in his State of the State address. He talked a lot about roads. He talked a little bit about early childhood ed and not at all about higher ed. So do you think that that is any kind of a sense of urgency or priority happening at the state capitol about this?
You know, it really depends. I think it depends upon, frankly, if there's an embarrassment factor in there. I think there might be. Is this something that they need to get more aggressive on? I also think the colleges and universities it is within their purview to be to show that they are good stewards of the almighty tax dollar, and if there are some additional things that they ought to be doing, if they ought to be trying to, for example, go after more out-of-state students, maybe they should be doing that. There's clearly an issue here, and I think business people are saying, look, we can't create jobs, and we're not going to invest here if we don't have the human capital here. And we need to have enough. I mean, another number that they threw out was 900,000 jobs in the state of Michigan by 2020 are going to require an associate's degree or higher.
Yes.
And if you don't have the people who have the degrees and the capability, those jobs are going to go unfilled. And, you know, as a general rule, I think the state has already got 20, 30, 40,000 jobs that are going unfilled because they don't have people with the right qualifications.
Dan Howe's piece in the Detroit News from Tuesday, The State Fails Higher Education Test. Dan, thanks for talking with us today on Stateside.
My pleasure.
And still ahead, we'll go from higher education to education at the earlier stages of life. We'll talk about the new push at the state capitol for an increase in money for early childhood education. That story coming up in 20 minutes. You're listening to Michigan Radio, and this is Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The cold snap certainly has Michigan in its frigid grasp for a second day. And for people who are living on the streets, these single-digit temps and below-zero wind chills are truly life-threatening. So we wanted to find out how shelters around the state are doing in their mission to help the homeless. From Mel Trotter Ministries in Grand Rapids, we're joined now by Reverend Chico Daniels, who's the president and CEO, and from Cass Community Social Services in Detroit, Executive Director Reverend Faith Fowler joins the show. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Reverend Fowler, I'll start with you. How many people would be staying at your shelter in the Cass Quarter on a normal night?
Well, in the Cass Quarter, we have a warming center. It's for 50 homeless women and children. Beyond that, we have two regular shelters and some transitional housing and permanent supportive housing. But the warming center is for 50 homeless women and children.
And on a typical evening, not one as brutal as this, are you at capacity normally?
It runs anywhere from 30 to 50, to tell you the truth, depending on a whole variety of things. But normally, there's a good number of women and children who need emergency shelter.
And with this dangerous cold snap, what's been the demand for your help?
We've been close to capacity both the last two nights. Mm-hmm.
And how do things look at the Mel Trotter Ministries in Grand Rapids, Reverend Daniels?
We are seeing our numbers increase as expected. We, in fact, we're cooperating with another ministry in the city to go out and encourage people to come out from under the bridges and some of the campsites that people feel that they can, you know, survive in the wild, so to speak, and And so our numbers have spiked due to the police corralling folk and getting them into the mission as well, in addition to the normal foot traffic flow that would be evident during this harsh winter.
So it sounds like you might be seeing some new faces coming in, especially with the effort to try to pull in people who might not want to turn to a shelter.
Yes, there are a few veterans and people who believe if they get intoxicated enough, they can numb themselves from the cold. And so every other year, you know, we have someone who freezes to death out there trying to make it on their own.
Reverend Fowler, are you getting assistance from Detroit or from Wayne County in what you're trying to do to protect the homeless in this cold snap?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the city of Detroit deserves a shout out. As a matter of fact, for this, they established two warming centers, and between the two, we can accommodate 250 homeless men, women, and children. And it's especially notable, I think, given the financial situation of Detroit right now, that they would make a priority of protecting people.
Can I just ask, just so I'm clear in my own mind, when you refer to a warming center, does that, are you allowing people to spend the night as well?
Yeah, yes. Since we work with so many children, our day actually starts at 4 in the afternoon to have them be able to access the church, actually, right after school, so they're not stranded outside. The other warming center doesn't open till 7, and then we remain open till 8 in the morning, so they can go directly from the warming center to school. And then on days where the temperatures drop below 20, we remain open till noon, till the sun comes up, and it's a little bit warmer for adults.
And then what happens at noon?
Well, quite frankly, we provide them with two bus tickets so they can go to some place that's warm. If they want to go to a library or a mall or somewhere, they're not stranded. Some have business to take care of, and so the bus ticket actually, tickets, one to get there, one to get back,
yeah,
actually is quite a help to them. Some can actually access other daytime facilities. There are a few in Detroit, although they're few and far between.
Reverend Daniels, there has to be such a sense of street smarts and surviving and that these folks would develop, but the safety net has a lot of holes, doesn't it?
It does, and, you know, there is a nationwide continuum of care movement to bring an end to homelessness, and that effort is valiant, but it is underfunded. And so organizations like Reverend Fowler's and mine, which I mentioned to you earlier, we are privately funded here. And so we are the safety net. We are the place of last resort, often for people who would otherwise be out in the elements. There are a lot of people who come to the mission after they've exhausted their stay with relatives and friends, and they come here. But we are the safety net, but there's room for improvement, obviously.
If you could wave that proverbial magic wand and find those improvements and put them in place, what would you do?
Well, I am a big fan of programs like Habitat for Humanity. We collaborate with them. We want the graduates of our what we call our SAVE program, which is in addition to the emergency shelter, we provide a one-year recovery program for people who are battling alcohol and drugs and addictions that have contributed to their homelessness. Not in all cases. We have people come here that are not addicts, but our one-year SAVE program gives people a chance to get off of the drugs and alcohol and rehabilitate their lives, and then we try to connect them with supportive housing. To Reverend Fowler's point, we built a day center last spring. We opened a new facility that after people leave our shelter in the morning, they can stay in the day center where we are better able to engage them around their job needs, their housing needs, and for those who need counseling, mental health services, we connect them with Veteran Affairs and the various other agencies in the city that can help bring an end to some of the crisis. that people are facing. We don't want people who are caught in situational poverty to become chronically homeless, and so we're trying to keep that from happening.
And Reverend Fowler, I'm wondering, in your work with the homeless and being there in the CAS corridor in Detroit, is essentially ground zero, if you will, of homelessness. And what kinds of stories do you hear from people that perhaps counteract the sense that the public may have about just who these people are?
Well, the sheer fact that so many of them are children.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the stereotype is it's a middle-aged man, and more it's women and children. The number of homeless children has skyrocketed 22% in the last couple of years. It's pretty hard to blame an 8-year-old
yes.
for being homeless. And yet we have a tendency as a culture to want to place blame. I mean, people become homeless for a variety of reasons, losing houses, losing jobs, losing spouses, mental health, veterans with mental health issues, domestic abuse, certainly some with recovery issues. I mean, there's not one reason, but we tend to sort of paint everybody with one brush, which is really unfair and doesn't help us, you know, get to the kinds of solutions Reverend Daniels was talking about.
And what other solutions would you want to add to that as well?
Clearly, there has to be more funding for mental health and more outreach for mental health. We have a PATH team, one of the PATH teams in Michigan, that actually goes out to do outreach to mentally ill individuals who aren't receiving services, therapy, medication, and many of whom are self-medicating or street medicating.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, capturing those folks and allowing them to sort of slowly and at their own pace work themselves back into a quality of life. You know, many of our women end up homeless because relationships have gone bad and work is near impossible because they have kids with no child care. Those are two major things I'd like to see us work at.
Reverend Faith Fowler, the Executive Director of CAS Community Social Services, and Reverend Chico Daniels, CEO, President, and Visionary at the Mel Trotter Ministries in Grand Rapids. Thanks for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you, Cindy.
You can learn more about the work these two agencies are doing to help homeless people in Kent County and in Wayne County. We've put links to their websites on our website. Just go to the Stateside link on michiganradio.org. There's a very rare opportunity coming up for fans of film. The 2013 Arab Film Festival will open this Thursday through Saturday in Dearborn. 8 Arab World films will be screened at the Arab American National Museum on Michigan Avenue. If you're a fan of Arabic language movies, or you're someone who seeks out films that bring new perspectives and films that view the world through different eyes, here's your chance to see films rarely screened in the United States. We're joined here in the studio now by Devin Ackman, who's one of the organizers of the Arab Film Festival. Devin, it's the 8th such festival. How has it grown over the years?
It's grown in a lot of ways. Constantly, things are changing in the Arab world. The demographics of the Arab American community are expanding and changing. So the Arab Film Festival really seeks to portray some of those changes, both domestically and abroad, and to tell the story of the Arab American community as well, isn't just the Arab community.
It's a big agenda that you have
yes.
with that. Get into some of the changes in the evolution of the kinds of films and the messages that they've been bringing.
Well, certainly since the onset of the Arab Spring, we've seen a rise of what's being called the new Arab cinema. This is a very self-reflective movement of filmmaking. It's addressing social, political issues. And there's a lot of migration happening with the filmmakers between the Arab world, Europe, North America. So this is a great opportunity to reflect on these changes that are taking place, to identify a potential new future. Some of the films which we're screening this year actually show these changes taking place in a continuum. So it's not a fixed beginning and ending. This is an ongoing process, and these filmmakers are depicting this through their films.
And you've got films from many countries. Give us an idea of where these films have come from.
One of the things we try to do in curating a festival is to be mindful of our local Arab American community. So, of course, we're living in a region that has the highest concentration of Arabs in North America. The majority of the community is Lebanese, Syrian, Palestinian, Iraqi. So our first concern is finding films that would be of interest to these communities, to reflect these communities, and to bridge kind of the Arab and Arab American experience. So that is our first concern when seeking out films for this festival.
So what countries? Obviously, you've got Lebanon.
We have films from Lebanon, Palestine. We have obviously a film from Egypt and one from Morocco as well.
Which is very rarely seen, isn't it? The Moroccan films don't usually get to see the light of day in the United States.
True. And there's a very, very vibrant film community coming out of Morocco right now.
When you talk about bridging the experience between the Arab world and the Arab American world, what are some of the difficult challenges in sharing those experiences?
Yeah, one of the more difficult challenges is to be first and foremost mindful of the diversity of the Arab American community. As I mentioned, we come from 22 different countries. We're Christian, we're Muslim, our time of immigration is different, our political views are different, our religious views are different. So, you know, if something is ongoing, for example, with what's happening in Syria, you know, you have to be mindful of the potential political wedge you could actually create by presenting or showing a particular form of art or a film. So being very careful to be respectful and not to be a wedge, but to be a source of information that could actually bridge people and to minimize some of the confusion.
Now, certainly, as you referred to, the Arab Spring uprisings have had a major, major impact on the films that are being made by Arab filmmakers. And a very good example of this is a film that is going to be screened at the 2013 Arab Film Festival. So, Devin, tell us a little about Half Revolution.
Well, Half Revolution is by two directors. It was co-directed by Omar Shagawi and Kareem El-Hakim. Kareem El-Hakim is actually an Egyptian-American. Both of them were in Cairo 2 years ago when the Arab Spring began in Tahrir Square. This is a film that, as the title suggests, is about this ongoing process. It doesn't say that there's a beginning or an end to what's happening in Egypt. And it's shot from the perspective of the filmmakers and their friends. So they're actually the cast. They're in front of the camera. They're behind the camera. And it's not in the same sense as some of the other films that are coming out, more of a documentaries based on traditional reporting. This is very much the experience of these individuals and the changes that took place in those days following the beginning of the January 25 revolution.
So let's listen to a brief clip from Half Revolution and get a sense of what this film is about.
This is what we've been dreaming of our whole life, mate. One day there's going to be an Arabic revolution and we're going to take back the power to the people.
So what's the power of this film? I know it's very much tied into such a major, major world event.
I think part of the power is just transformation and opportunity and hope. You know, these are themes that are being celebrated around the world. It's themes that are being celebrated by our own president in the inaugurational speech. So this opportunity, this maybe uncertainty about the future, but a sense that there is a new future coming, a cautious optimism, and perhaps a time of new hope and renewal.
Devin Ackman, tell me, what are the films you're most excited about?
I'm personally very excited about the feature on the very first night. So as you can see, our film festival is a combination of a short and a feature. We have four blocks. And the very first night is a film by an upcoming Arab American filmmaker named Susan Youssef. Susan was born and raised in New York. She's a Lebanese Syrian by heritage. And her film, Habibi Rasak Karban, actually translates to Darling, Something is Wrong with Your Head, is a very, very, very interesting portrayal of a Palestinian experience. And it's portrayed through a 7th century Sufi parable called Majnun Layla, which is actually very much like the Western version of Romeo and Juliet. Hmm. So this is about these two students who are living in the West Bank, and they return to Gaza, and their opportunity and their hope for a love affair, despite all of these social and political constraints, and how they go about using graffiti to express their love throughout the city. So it's a take on a very traditional tale through the Arab perspective, and it's bringing in a lot of the social and political commentary of its time.
And it seems, especially since you say it's kind of a reflection of the Romeo and Juliet story, something that a non-Arabic audience member could relate to the story and then get that Arabic perspective put into it.
Certainly, and that's a great opportunity to portray the Palestinian story, the Palestinian experience, without being overtly political. It's a love story. It's a very approachable, something that we can all connect to.
What other films are you personally really excited about?
Well, I'm very, very interested in Here, which is the short before Half Revolution. It's very much looking at this kind of combination of who's the oppressor, who is the innocent, the victim, the political system. So that's a film coming out of Jordan, and that'll be a really great combination of Here and then Half Revolution. And we're very, very pleased to have the university's very own Professor Juan Cole introducing those films that night.
And they all have English subtitles, correct?
Yes.
So they're accessible to everybody.
Yes, they're accessible.
So what would be your hope that a non-Arabic audience member, what's your hope that they might understand about the Arab world and the Arab-American world from these films?
Well, as you alluded to earlier, there's a certain sense of empathy, first and foremost, the ability to connect and say, hey, I understand that. That's something that's very similar to my family's history or something that I believe in. And we feel that the arts are a very powerful vehicle in that way to connect people. So first and foremost, we're hoping that people can identify with an aspect of these films and that'll resonate and they can walk away with a new understanding of the Arab and Arab American experience.
Devin Ackman is one of the organizers of the 2013 Arab Film Festival. And the details on the festival are on the website of the Arab American Museum. And we have put a link to that up on our website at michiganradio.org. And once again, it opens Thursday and runs through Saturday at the Arab American Museum. Thanks for joining us today, Devin.
Thanks for having me.
Governor Snyder says he wants to see more money for early childhood education in the new state budget. We'll take a look at how likely this is to happen. That is coming up next, and this is Stateside. Stateside, I'm Cynthia Canty. Early childhood education funding seems to have made its way to the front burner in Lansing. Governor Snyder announced his support for more money for early childhood education during his State of the State address last week.
We have 29,000 students that are eligible for a program to get them into preschool. I don't believe we can accomplish all that, and I'm open to coming up with creative ideas to get there. But I think it's important we make a major commitment, a major budget commitment, to get as many kids in as possible and get us on a path to getting all those kids in Great Start and an early childhood program.
And this comes as Republican State Senator Roger Kahn's also been pushing for a funding increase. Michigan Radio's Jennifer Guerra and Dustin Dwyer have been spending months and months taking a look at early childhood education, all part of our State of Opportunity project, and they join me now. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Cynthia.
Jen, I'm going to start with you. Tell us, what was the reaction after the governor at least mentioned funding for early childhood education in his speech? Was it well received, or were people a little disappointed that there wasn't more attention?
I think it'd be safe to say it's sort of a mixed bag. It depends who you talk to. A number of early child advocates that I spoke to were actually just really geeked, was one of the words that somebody used. They were really geeked that Governor Snyder had even mentioned early childhood education, and they were really excited that it was getting a mention. But then when you sort of start to dive into the speech a little bit more and we start talking numbers, when we start talking dollars, I think it's safe to say it's sort of a different story.
So what are we talking in terms of the cost of getting those 29,000 eligible little ones into that preschool?
Well, Senator Kahn, who you mentioned, he has been pushing for $140 million, and that would cover half-day preschool for those 29,000, most of the 29,000. And if you listen to Governor Snyder's bite, he says, I don't believe we can accomplish all that. So that's $140 million. And right before he had said that, he had spent about 5 or 6 minutes talking about roads and bridges and how he thought it was a very big priority to do $1.2 billion in increased funding for roads and bridges. And so when you look at it in that light, it seems like not all priorities are funded equally.
And I want to talk about what we'd be getting for this kind of education. What does the data show that is important to understand with regards to kids getting this kind of education at such a young age?
So one of the things that, I mean, we're talking about preschool funding in the context of what we're spending on roads, and the research shows that actually both investments pay off, and in some analyses they actually pay off similarly. One person I talked to said road investments return about 5% per year on the money you spend. The return on investment for preschool, depending on who you talk to, it can be in the range of 6 to 10%. Per year. And if you sort of compound that interest out, depending on who you talk to, again, we're talking about a 3-to-1 return on investment for preschool. Some people say that investment can go up as high as a 7-to-1 return on investment cumulatively. And the reason is because kids who go to preschool, the data shows they are more likely to graduate high school. They're less likely to need sort of remedial classes or special education, so you'll save money in the schools. They also earn more money when they're adults. So Tim Bartik, an economist at the Upjohn Institute, he calculates the return on investment from preschool purely on a per capita earnings basis. So just by increasing the earnings of the state residents and by factoring out those who will move out of the state, which certain people will, he says you're still getting $3 for every dollar invested in preschool.
And Jen, we're talking about high quality early childhood education. We're not just talking about daycare. Can you kind of elaborate on that for us?
Right. That's a really good point. There are, and you can tell when you walk into different preschools that you sort of get a vibe. And there is a difference between a high quality preschool, a preschool, and a daycare. And I think the model that has been set would be through the HiSCOPE Foundation. They're the ones that did the Perry Preschool. We've talked about the Perry Preschool study a lot in our coverage, and it's one of the 40 years of data that shows what goes into a good preschool and the results that come from kids going to that preschool. And they sort of broke it down into four things that all high-quality preschools should have. They said engaged parents, a way to evaluate students, active learning, and good teachers. Those were sort of the four tenets of a good high-quality preschool. Active learning, meaning the kids have to be engaged. It's not just top-down. It's not just the teachers telling the kids what to do. It's child-initiated, and then they review what they did. They talk about it. And good teachers, that was sort of the really big one, because it costs a lot of money to pay for quality teachers. And the gentleman I spoke with at HiSCOPE said that really makes all the difference.
And Dustin Dwyer, there's really a scientific part to all of this, isn't there? About the idea of being able to actually mold youngsters' brains when they're quite young.
Yeah, in terms of there's interesting research that's happened really just in the last couple of years in terms of the biology of the brain. And what we all have this idea that young kids, you know, age 3 or 4, that everyone says their brains are like sponges. But there's been a lot of neuroscientists now are scanning brains, and they're doing all these tests to sort of determine exactly what kids are learning and how they're learning. And it's just incredible that what they're finding just reaffirms that if a kid doesn't have the right learning opportunities at home, and let's remember that, you know, if we're talking about kids who are qualifying for Head Start or the Great Start Readiness Program, their parents are low income, they probably work long hours. Research has shown that there are not as many books in the home for these kids, and not as many learning opportunities. So what happens is their brains are physically changed. Their brains are literally different if they don't get some sort of intervention, if someone doesn't come along and sort of teach them some of the skills that we talk about when we're talking about preschool. So absolutely, the science is reaffirming some of the things that we've thought we knew about preschool.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and we are talking with Michigan Radio's Jennifer Guerra and Dustin Dwyer, who have been taking a real deep dive into early childhood education and where it's at in Michigan as part of our State of Opportunity project. I'm kind of curious, Jen, couldn't one argue, well, we have Head Start, and isn't that high-quality early childhood education? So where would this state's Great Start Readiness Program fit into that? Are we duplicating, or does it give you more?
Actually, no, it gives you less, I would say. Mm-hmm. Head Start, there are different ways to qualify for Head Start and the Great Start Readiness Program. Head Start, you have to be at the 100% poverty level. So for a family of four, I think that's mm-hmm. right around $23,000, $24,000. For GSRP, it's 300% of the poverty level
okay.
to qualify. But to me, I think, and Dustin can probably talk to this much more since he's done a lot of research on Head Start, but there are wraparound services with Head Start where the whole family sort of gets incorporated into the betterment of the child. Mm-hmm. And with Great Start Readiness Program, there's just not a lot of funding for it. So it's the half day and transportation isn't necessarily provided to get the child to the school. So, yeah, it's not as full service.
But it opens the doors to more kids.
Mm-hmm. Right, it does. Yeah. Yes, more children qualify. Yeah. And but again, the state only provides, you know, so much money for GSRP. And so you've got these 29,000 eligible four-year-olds who still can't get a slot because there aren't mm-hmm. enough spots open.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, you find lots of kids who, one thing that's different is that the state-run program doesn't accept three-year-olds, you know. So GSRP is entirely for four-year-olds. Head Start accepts three-year-olds, and Head Start has a smaller program that's Early Head Start, which accepts them even younger. You know, we were just talking about the brain science. The brain science doesn't say that kids suddenly come online at age four, and if you're there with preschool, you'll save them. I mean, in some cases, there's a lot of research that shows that if you start even earlier, you'll help them even more. And that's a whole other aspect of early childhood education that we're almost not addressing at all.
So if we have this data and there's a clear understanding that this kind of education in these very, very early years it's life-changing, it's that important, why is it it's taken Lansing so long to act and really taking an historic look at it, not just since Governor Snyder came in, but why has it taken Lansing so long to move on this?
Well, I think the reason is that we didn't know until really in the last 10 years just how much of a return on investment we get from preschool. I mean, I think we've known Head Start has been around since 1965. So it's been at least that long that we've sort of known that intervening early in the lives of children can make a difference. But, you know, we talk about what you get out of these programs. Well, when they're measuring the effects of these programs, there's a couple different ways you can measure it. You can look at how the kids do on sort of standardized tests, and there's a lot of people who measure the effects of preschool that way. And it turns out that's sort of a disappointing way to measure the effects of preschool, because in most studies you look at, say, the reading skills or the math skills of kids who attended preschool, they sort of fade in relation to the other kids in their elementary school. So some of those benefits kind of wash out. But when then you go back years later when they're adults, you see many more of those benefits show up again. So in the Perry study, the Perry preschool study in Ypsilanti that Jen was just talking about, they're following people who are now, I think, in their 40s or 50s. I mean, so it just takes a long time to get that data. And for economists to crunch it, they just started crunching it in the last 10 years or so. And then it made its way sort of to the business community. And then the business community has been pushing preschool now in the state of Michigan. And so it's sort of just taken that long to understand the effects.
And again, this idea of return on investment, mm-hmm. you know, business people, they're money people, they're numbers people. And
ROI
they see,
matters.
Exactly. And so they see that high quality early education really does pay off, literally. And so that's why the business community is getting behind it as well.
And is that why we're seeing, for example, Senator Kahn being on board with this, and now we're hearing businessman Rick Snyder being on board? Is that really why we're at this moment in time right now?
Yeah, one Department of Education official I spoke with, she said that there's now the political will behind early mm-hmm. education, and she did point her finger directly at the business community and said, it's not the usual suspects who are the ones advocating for early education at this point. Now the business community is getting into it. Chambers of commerce are getting into it. There are over, I think, 200 employers across the state who have sort of signed a petition saying early education is important to our state. You know, Michigan, we should fund it. And I think that's, yeah, it's really helping push the ball forward.
So do you think this increase in funding will happen?
Oh, I wouldn't take bets on that. I mean, it seems like from what we're hearing that something will happen. Mike Flanagan, the state superintendent of education, he was quoted saying around $75 million of an increase, which would be an increase of 70% compared to the current funding for the state preschools program. Jennifer, you've talked to some people who said numbers a little bit lower. So this is even that, I mean, it's tough to sort of say that amount would be a huge increase compared to current standards, but it would be kind of like half of what Khan thinks we need to really make it available to all four-year-olds. So something will happen. It's still an open question how much. And how much political effort is going to be put into this? I mean, we started talking about roads. The governor is out there campaigning for a tax increase for roads, and he is not campaigning in that same way about preschool, although certainly preschool advocates some preschool advocates are happy with what he did say.
And Dustin Dwyer and Jennifer Guerra are part of Michigan Radio's State of Opportunity Project. You can find past reports from the State of Opportunity team. Go online at michiganradio.org. And be sure to tune in for the special State of Opportunity documentary on early childhood education. It's tomorrow afternoon at 3. Dustin Dwyer will dive into the neuroscience of early brain development and talk about why preschool is especially important for children in poverty. So let's continue talking about early childhood education funding. Let's talk about the politics of the issue. Rick Pluta is Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. Rick, we have been talking about how Governor Snyder is behind this funding push, but let's take a look back about a decade ago when then-Governor Jennifer Granholm came into office. She was ready to go to push for more early childhood education, but she didn't get nearly as far as she'd hoped. What happened there?
Yeah, as she wanted that. If she had a bigger priority than early childhood programs as a candidate and as a nascent governor, I'm not aware of it. She called for it in her first State of the State address, but she didn't actually put state money into it. She called on foundations to provide more for it because she understood the budget realities that she was facing at that time. And for Jennifer Granholm, those budget pressures never relented. Mm. And so she was never able to create the universal preschool that she really dreamed of. So, now you fast forward, years later, Governor Snyder, still picks that up. No one argues the value of early childhood preschool programs. As a matter of fact, I mean, here's one stark number that just got thrown at me today, that 13,500 kids flunk out of kindergarten in Michigan.
Wow.
In a year.
Every year.
The cost of sending those kids back to kindergarten, the cost of the system, is $80 million. So people recognize that, there are costs, that if you have kids in preschool, that it's easier to educate them later on and they do better in the later grades, that they're more likely to go to college. They're less likely to go to prison, which, of course, is a big savings for taxpayers and just, a better overall society. But, the problem here is everyone wants to go to heaven, but no one wants to die.
Yeah, meaning no one wants the money coming out of their budget.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Any budget is a statement. It's a statement of values and it's a statement of politics. The values are anyone's individual values. The politics is how you take all of those and put them together to create a spending plan that everyone can agree with. And the latter part has been the complication here. So, just to name one, the governor is going to, I am told, put money, a significant amount of money, into expanding Great Start into the budget that is going to be presented in early February. It will expand Great Start. They will talk about the things they're going to do in Great Start, but it's all going to be reallocated from existing resources. That means that there are gooses out there that are going to get plucked and they're going to squawk.
Yes.
When the governor talked about Great Start in the State of the State, afterwards, school groups, administrators and whatnot came out and said, "We applaud the governor's commitment to Great Start. don't take the money out of K-12. As a matter of fact, if there is more money, some of it should be going to K-12. Those are the sorts of fights that we're going to see. And that's really that sort of fighting is what's kept Great Start expanding into a universal preschool program like Governor Granholm dreamed of, you know, so many years ago.
In the meantime, 29,000 little children need that start, need that help to get in and succeed in kindergarten.
At a minimum cost of $3,400 per.
Mm. Much to watch as this unfolds, especially with that budget address coming up soon. Rick Pluta, thanks so much.
Oh, my pleasure, Cindy.
Rick Pluta is the Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. And as I mentioned earlier to you, be sure to tune in to Michigan Radio tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock for a special State of Opportunity documentary. It'll be an hour-long look at why early education, high-quality preschool, is so vital for children, particularly those living in poverty. You can learn more online. Just go to michiganradio.org. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Maya Friedman, Emily Fox, Cameron Stewart, and Mercedes Mejia. This program's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk again on Monday.